This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Welcome to another edition of Layla Weighs In here on Intelligent Medicine. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for downloading these podcasts. I want to continue from last week. Last week I was talking about the surge in celiac disease as described in this wonderful article in The Scientist magazine by Catherine Offord. The prevalence of celiac disease. If you recall, if you listened to last week's podcast, we talked about how scientists were trying to extrapolate the incidence of celiac disease to the general population, and they found that the incidence was higher than once thought. Now, around 40% of people have the genes predisposing them to the disease, but even when they look at genetic factors, they wonder why some develop it and others don't. So it's not just a matter of having the two genes coding for HLA-DQ, 2 and 8, but there's just more to it than that. The question is why some people get it, some people don't, and they're wondering about the introduction of gluten, at what age, and they're finding that the science there is very weak as well. They also looked at the environment, looking outside of our DNA. And researchers have looked at plasticware, diatomaceous earth, microwaves, things of that nature to say, well, what role is that playing, these particular toxic exposures? And the role of gluten itself. So far, we believe it's gliadin. But there are many subfractions in gluten that may also be at play, not yet identified or associated. But so far, gliadin is to blame. And then finally, the Food and Drug Administration notes that wheat consumption increased rapidly in the second part of the 20th century as people began to eat less meat and consume increasing amounts of readily available wheat-containing fast foods. And if you notice, if you listen to last week's podcast, we also talked about, in quotes, Frankenwheat, that our wheat crop today is very different from what it was 100, 200 years ago. Today, our wheat crop is more like a dwarf wheat or a super gluten, as described by Dr. Mark Hyman. It has super starch, amylopectin A, and gluten has an opiate effect. So when we eat bread or we eat pastry, we want more, and it could be the opiate effect of the wheat. So not just that sugar in the pastry. Okay. And then the amount of gluten may matter. Say scientists, they have to go back and revisit what's happening with gluten, how much we're eating, and is it a potential risk factor? So I'll pick it up from there. Reactions to these findings have been mixed. Again, the evidence is fairly weak. This is from researcher Detlef Schuppan of Johannes Gutenberg University in Germany. In terms of the global rise in celiac prevalence, the amount of gluten ingested does not explain it. So, Amidst uncertainty about gluten's part in the celiac trend, researchers are quick to point out that it's not just our diet that has changed in the last century. One factor now under scrutiny across digestive diseases and beyond is humans' usage of antibiotics, and consequently, the composition of bacteria making up the gut microbiome. The bacteria living in the gut, they do play an important role in metabolism and in the regulation of immune responses to food. And so much, you know, I'm veering off here, so much of our food intolerances, sensitivities, not necessarily true allergy, may be because of our microbiome. If we're able to change the microbiome, many of those symptoms may subside. So our microbiome in the gut does play an important role in immune response, in metabolism. So for many researchers, these microbes are likely suspects in celiac disease pathogenesis, in the evolution of celiac disease in individuals. So according to this line of thinking, maybe the bugs we've got now are not as happy when they interact with gluten. Very, very, very well said, Dr. Murray. Or the results are not as good for us when these bugs interact with gluten as when our old bugs did. Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm sure it does to a lot of you listening. Our microbiome has changed significantly. The use of antibiotics, medications, toxic exposures, additives, preservatives in our food, the use of hormones and antibiotics in livestock, all of that is impacting our microbiome. And the change in the wheat crop, it used to be an acorn wheat. It wasn't the super gluten as it is today. So, the last two decades have seen a number of observational studies report abnormal microbiome composition in the guts of celiac patients compared with healthy controls. Patients with celiac show a higher proportion of gram-negative bacteria, such as Bacteroides and E. coli, for example. And some evidence suggests that those displaying gastrointestinal symptoms also have higher levels of proteobacteria. Another bacterium, you've heard of this, H. pylori, Helicobacter pylori, has been associated with protection from celiac disease. And declines in the number of adults carrying this microbe in their guts appears to have coincided with increases in the number of celiac cases in the U.S., although research on the subject remains inconclusive. I want to talk about this. H. pylori, we know, as cause of ulcer and something like that, possible cause of gastric cancer, stomach cancer. Anytime a doctor is looking to see if you have Helicobacter pylori and they find that you come up positive for it, they're treating it with a triple dose of antibiotics, three different antibiotics, to kill off that. Now, what I've seen as a result of this treatment therapy to eradicate H. pylori, then patients come in with intractable GERD and hoarseness, vocal hoarseness. They are in a constant state of reflux from this therapy. So it is possible that H. pylori is actually a commensal, a kind of okay, neutral, or even good neighbor as part of our microbiome, and now, interestingly, can be protective against celiac disease. Now, another thing that we can maybe hypothesize about the prevalence and incidence of celiac disease is there's more eradication of H. pylori. That could be another reason for the incidence of celiac. So, anyway, whether these differences in microbiome composition are the cause or the consequence of celiac remains unanswered. So which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the change in microbiome cause more diagnoses of celiac? Did celiac upset the microbiome so much that that's what we're seeing, is the reason we're seeing these changes in microbiome? You could think about it several ways. Maybe there's a difference in the microbiota from the beginning, and this has a causative role. Or maybe what you're seeing is just a secondary effect. At this point, we really don't know. So, circumstantial evidence is accumulating to suggest more than a passive role for these microbes. For starters, it's known that changes in the microbiota can induce different types of immune responses, and celiac patients often continue to show abnormal gut flora even after adopting a gluten-free diet. I want to say something about that. Even, and I've seen this myself in my celiac patients, that 6 months, a year later, they're still finding to have abnormal gut flora, or they're still high in anti-gliadin antibodies, transglutaminase, endomysial antibodies, all of that. And we blame cross-reactivity for that. Or the people who are on a gluten-free diet are still eating out more often than they should, or not as careful about how they're sourcing their food. But there is cross-reactivity, with even some non-gluten grains like millet can be problematic. So for many of those who are not getting remission of or changes to a more healthier brush border or intestinal villi, microbilli, if we're still finding it flat, we may have to go further. It may demand a more austere diet, which is very interesting. So additionally, a study last year, mice engineered to overexpress interleukin-15, a cytokine involved in celiac disease pathogenesis, had restructured microbiota as well as altered production of certain fatty acids, mirroring precursors of intestinal inflammatory disease in humans, IBD. When you put all this together, you could say that there really is enough evidence to believe in a causative role for the microbiota. But these critical experiments still need to be done. You know, the jury is still out on this. So with all these factors being investigators, say researchers, it's unlikely the explanation for an increase in celiac disease incidence will be simple. I don't think we're going to be able to find a single environmental trigger. It's going to be a combination. There are so many things going on, so many moving parts. The challenge for us as scientists is to reduce it down to a testable hypothesis. That could be a tall order. So, remember, when you develop celiac disease, you can't undevelop it. You can heal it by avoiding gluten, but you can't put Humpty Dumpty together again because the immune system has changed. So as you know, for now, the only treatment for celiac disease is a complete eradication of gluten, a gluten-free diet. But the focus on celiac disease has intensified. So too has research on the effects of this intervention, and the results are not encouraging. Several studies suggest that celiac patients' guts are unlikely to heal completely, even on such a diet. An accidental ingestion of gluten is almost inevitable. Even tiny amounts can trigger symptoms. Moreover, patients find the gluten-free regimen difficult to tolerate because it's isolating, it's often impractical. And in 2011, University of Sheffield celiac researcher David Sanders and his team surveyed 310 people diagnosed with celiac disease who were following a gluten-free diet and found that more than 40% were dissatisfied. I see that a lot in my practice. Most people eat three times a day, and with celiac disease, that's a challenge. So to improve outcomes for patients with celiac, some scientists are exploring ways to tackle the celiac gut's response to gluten and potentially restore tolerance. Celiac researcher and chief scientific officer of Immusan T, Bob Anderson, for example, is expanding work he began during a postdoc at the University of Oxford to develop a vaccine that could help desensitize patients to gluten over a series of injections. Let me tell you about this vaccine. NexVax2 comprises three peptides, components of gluten taken from wheat, barley, and rye, that trigger an adaptive immune response in celiac patients. Phase 1 results showed the vaccine to be safe. Phase 2 trials are planned for later this year, Anderson says. It's a highly targeted approach to try to engage the bulk of the gluten-reactive T cells that play a pivotal role in causing and maintaining the disease. That could be very promising. I know that for many, being completely gluten-free is a quality of life issue. I understand this as a nutritionist. There are less orthodox approaches in the works too. In recent years, researchers in Australia have been investigating the idea that attacking the body with intestinal parasites could help mitigate the effects of autoimmune disease by giving the immune system something to do. You know about the hygiene hypothesis, right? We are so clean and practically germ-free that our immune systems are bored. So out of its boredom, it's attacking itself. So by introducing something like parasites could give the immune system something to do. So in 2014, this team in Australia reported results from 12 people with celiac disease who, after being experimentally infected with hookworm larvae, which then migrated to the gut and grew, could follow a normal diet with significantly reduced symptoms. This is absolutely fascinating. The same researchers plan to launch a follow-up double-blind randomized trial with 60 participants later this year and have stated that the results could inform future development of new non-parasite-based therapies. Who wants to take parasites, right? Other experimental therapeutics for celiac disease would require patients to continue a gluten-free diet but serve to reduce the severity of reactions to accidental exposure when taken before a meal. Baltimore-based pharmaceutical company Alba Therapeutics, co-founded by Alessio Fasano, one of the top researchers and doctors of celiac disease, has developed pills containing a synthetic peptide known as Lirazotide acetate, which inhibits a protein called zonulin that regulates epithelial cell tight junctions. It's zonulin that's responsible for that. Zonulin is thought to increase the permeability of the gut and is upregulated in people with celiac disease. Dr. Joseph Prezzorno wrote at length about the role of zonulin. So researchers suggested could explain why the drug reduces GI symptoms in celiac patients following gluten-free exposure. So this therapy targeting zonulin or inhibiting zonulin was licensed out for phase 3 trials last year. And another experimental drug developed by California-based Alvine Therapeutics and recently acquired by Immunogen X, contains a mixture of two gluten-targeting proteases, one plant-derived, one derived from bacteria. The drug chops gluten molecules into successfully smaller pieces and reduce gut tissue damage in celiac patients who ingested small amounts in the phase 2 trial. Now, coming back to what Peter Green said, Dr. Peter Green, known doctor in celiac disease, Columbia University, in his book said, the problem with gluten, it's a 33 amino acid peptide that human beings lack the particular enzymes to break down. So, taking certain proteases, that could be another targeted therapy. This is all very, very promising. So, it's not just celiac patients who have difficulty with gluten. Thousands of Americans report symptoms following consumption of gluten-containing foods, abdominal pain, other GI problems. Even once they've ruled out celiac disease as well as other grain intolerance, wheat allergy. But unlike celiac disease, in which patient symptoms are known to be directly triggered by consumption of gluten, the causes of non-celiac gluten sensitivity are far less understood. I have lots of patients with wheat allergy. And some research even suggests that in many patients, gluten might have nothing to do with it. So, a study done at Monash in Australia, 37 people with self-reported non-celiac gluten sensitivity, 92% showed no gluten-specific symptoms when following a diet controlled by researchers. In a more recent Italian study of 35 people, found similar results. Two-thirds of people diagnosed with non-celiac gluten sensitivity based on their symptoms showed no reaction to gluten when it was reintroduced in a gluten-free diet. But if gluten isn't behind these symptoms of many non-celiac gluten sensitivity patients, then what is? Might be FODMAPs. Those are the fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. So that might be something. There's a lot to be learned here. And from these and related findings, many scientists argue that gluten in non-celiac gluten sensitivity is misleading and instead prefer non-celiac wheat sensitivity. For now, though, as researchers work to pin down the causes and the prevalence of this condition, this term sticks. Wonderful article in The Scientist by Catherine Offord. I want to thank you for joining me on another edition of Layla Weighs In here on Intelligent Medicine. This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients regularly along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.